atheists. How many of you know these characters?
Some of them.
Who's this? That's not Darwin.
Richard
Dawkins.
Darwin.
No. He looks like Darwin. No. It's PZ Myers. Sam Harris. You know who that is.
Number four.
Christopher Hitchens. Lawrence Krauss.
I've seen that guy.
Theoretical physicist.
I've seen him.
Paul Myers.
That's it.
There's some more, but these are some of the people who are considered to be the new atheists, the intelligent people of our time who deny God's existence, apparently. Well, what is the new atheism? The new atheism, according to skepticdictionary.com, new atheism is an expression used primarily to distinguish secular thinkers who argue that religious faith and belief in gods are dangerous and destructive because they are essentially irrational and encourage irrationality and anti-scientific thinking. There's a lot in there, isn't it? Very important words here. They believe that belief in gods are dangerous. They think you are dangerous people because you are irrational and anti-scientific. In other words, you are blundering fools. You are idiots with guns, kind of thing. The key idea shared by the new atheist seems to be one, science has demonstrated that a god is an unnecessary hypothesis. Two, religion has demonstrated that it is a destructive social force that brings about much more harm than good, including but not limited to anti-evolutionist ideas. Oh my. Three, atheists are sick and tired of being ignored or treated as if they don't exist. The new atheists might be seen as responding in part to the new creationists, the defenders of so-called intelligent design. The new creationists are seen by the new atheists as abusers of science, whose main goal is to attack evolutionary science and break down the division between church and state. The new atheists not only actively oppose religion wherever religion threatens science and society, but also actively promote virtues and value of secularism. If there is any unifying belief among the new atheists, it is the belief that we should try to make the world a more rational place to live in, and that the actions most likely to bring about such a world are 1, those that encourage science-based thinking and human arts, and 2, those that bring an end to superstition, irrationality, and anti-scientific thinking. New atheists are like mathematicians. Whenever somebody makes an outrageous claim about the supernatural, they ask for proof. So that's who they claim to be. People who are rational, scientists, and deny anything that is outrageous and irrational and anti-scientific. There are many in the new atheist camp. In fact, this form of atheism seems to be the popular trend nowadays. Well-known names and influential people of new atheism includes Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, P.Z. Myers, Lawrence Krauss, and many others. You might recognize the guy on the far left as well, Penn Jillette, very famous magician, actually. Also quite a well-known atheist in him as well.
Comedian.
Yeah, very well-known comedian. If you ever watch his stand-up routines, you will see a lot of his atheism coming out. Some of the books include The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins, God Is Not Great by Christopher Hitchens. I think Christopher Hitchens is probably the best out of them, it's sort of the one that I like the most is Christopher Hitchens, if I can put it that way. I think he's very intelligent, very nice to listen to him. He's got an incredible vocabulary, very compelling in his arguments. He generally tries to make fair arguments about his opponents, although obviously I do think he is wrong. But out of all of them, I think he's got the most class, if I can put it that way.
God is not great is implying that there is a God.
Well, I don't know. We didn't find out. The End of Faith and Letter to a Christian Nation by Sam Harris. Sam Harris is a neuroscientist, and he has a podcast, quite a well-known one, called Waking Up. That's the name of his, got series on that and all kinds of things. The Universe from Nothing, Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing by Lawrence Krauss. He's a theoretical physicist. He sort of tries to answer the question, you know, where did everything come from? And he says he's got a pretty good answer for that. But in order for him to answer that question, he has to define what nothing is, which is quite confusing. The Happy Atheist by P.Z. Myers. Here's a write-up on the book of Amazon. This funny and fearless book collects and expands on some of his most popular writings, giving the religious fanaticism of our time the gleeful disrespect it deserves by skewering the apocalyptic fantasies, magical thinking, hypocrisies, and pseudoscientific theories advanced by religious fundamentalists of all stripes. These men, who are associated with New Atheism, are actually very intelligent and use their respective fields of expertise to attack faith-based worldviews. In fact, a great part of the appeal of New Atheism is the general feel of the movement is intellectual supremacy. Anyone who is not an anti-theist, like these men claim to be, is seen as stupid, uninformed, and outdated. In fact, the word anti-theist was popularized by Christopher Hitchens. He says he's not an atheist, one of these people who does not believe in God, but maybe wishes there was a God, or is open to the idea of a God. He is an anti-theist. He does not believe in God, he does not want there to be a God, does not like the idea of God, and even if there was a God, he would not worship him. He thinks God is a megalomaniacal monster and all of these different adjectives. The constant bludgeoning rhetoric from the new atheist is an us versus them arrogant argumentation. We are scientists. We believe in fact, not fiction. We analyze data while you blindly follow your man-made myths. While this may sound very impressive, it is far from the truth. So here are some of the arguments that they make. The first is that Christians are stupid. I interviewed some non-believers from a suburb where I grew up, and I asked them what their major objections to Christianity are. And here are some of the responses from those who call themselves atheists, skeptics, or anti-theists. One man said to me, "It's a business, a scam, preying on the minds of the gullible and ignorant, and teaching people to be satisfied with not knowing, because they can just attribute things that are inexplicable to a superstition instead of actually doing the research. This was fine thousands of years ago, but now science can explain quite a lot." Another one said, "It encourages the willing suspension of our critical thinking, creating a gullible people. Religion has robbed man of his understanding of morality, his understanding of the world, and his understanding of himself, dismissing science and fact in favor of Bronze Age mythology." Well, actually, Christianity is older than Bronze Age, but anyway, isn't it interesting that he uses terms that actually don't belong to him? Mm-hmm. See if you can see them. Religion has robbed man of his understanding of morality. It's not really a term that, when I say belongs to atheists, it's not a term that they really value much. It's not a term that they can properly understand. His understanding of the world.
Since they believe morality is subjective anyway.
Well, they believe that basically we are just stardust, and everything is stardust, one big cosmic accident. There isn't much to understand. Even the word understanding doesn't really belong to an atheist. Because in an atheist's worldview, very important, you are evolved stardust, and all your brain is just sort of matter in motion. It's just this thing that's releasing chemicals and gases and causing your body to react in a certain way. The term understanding, to have critical thinking, to agree or disagree, doesn't really belong in their worldview. It doesn't fit in their worldview, because whatever you think in their worldview is just the product of the chemicals in your brain. And so in an atheist worldview, really, I should just be a Christian because the chemicals in my brain have reacted in such a way that have made me a Christian. And you are an atheist because the chemicals in your brain have reacted in such a way that has made you an atheist. So what is there to debate? Unless, of course, there is some kind of transcendent truth that we need to get at. But they cannot admit to that, because then they must believe that there is something transcendent. When there's something transcendent, means there must be a transcendent being. Anyway, it's quite a long, complicated argument. As Hitchens said, faith causes people to be more mean, more selfish, and perhaps above all, more stupid. New atheism is a term to describe people who find religion and faith to be mainly destructive cultural forces. However, we must respond. Christianity is a reasonable faith. It is based on incontrovertible historical facts. Christians are not asking people to surrender their cognitive capabilities. The Christian faith is one that promotes dialogue and reason. Humans are created in the image of God, and the mind is part of the image, with the focal point of people being able to know God. In fact, the Bible describes God as an intellectual being. He is the one who creates us with brains to think, reason, and believe. Unbelievers are not requested to abandon their logical faculties. Instead, they are requested to engage with the facts of the Christian faith and understand their sin, Christ, repentance, and faith. We are not calling people to simply believe something without understanding. We are calling people to understand things and then believe in them. This from Richard Dawkins.
I think we should look at the history of religion and be fascinated by it, just as we look at the history of art and so on. But I don't think that religion has anything useful to teach us. One of the main reasons why people are religious is because they're persuaded by the apparent design of living things. And that's completely destroyed by Darwin. If you actually read any book by a biologist about evolution, it's hard to see how you could fail to be persuaded of it. The evidence is just absolutely apparent. There's no doubt about it. It's not a controversial issue. It's completely certain. It's as certain as the fact that the Earth and the other planets orbit the Sun. More than 40% of the American population, if opinion polls are to be believed, think that the world is less than 10,000 years old. And that's a shocking figure. It shows deep, profound ignorance. It sounds very laudable to teach the controversy, to teach both theories, but there aren't two theories. There's only one theory around. There's only one game in town as far as serious science is concerned. Of course, you get negative reactions from creationists, but who cares about creationists? They don't know anything.
Okay, there you have just a snippet of the kind of rhetoric that they like to use. It's stupid people. I mean, obviously, right? We're scientists, we're critical thinkers. Biology is proven.
Only one theory,
right. So what does he say? Religion doesn't have anything useful to teach us, says the former professor of Oxford University, which is an institution started by Christians, just by the way. Dawkins argues that people are tricked by the apparent design which was destroyed by Darwin. He argues there is no doubt about evolution, it is completely certain. Those people who think that the Earth is less than 10,000 years old show deep, profound ignorance. There is only one theory. Who cares about creationists? Because they don't know anything. This is not unique to Dawkins. Atheists often claim that those who do not agree with evolution are anti-scientific, and those who are scientists but dispute evolution are not true scientists. Therefore, their argument is generally virtually all scientists agree that evolution is a fact. Heard this many times. All scientists agree. But what about the scientists who are creationists? So they're not real scientists. So all of your scientists agree that evolution is a fact. I was told, it has been pointed out to me that a 2009 Pew survey was done claiming that 97% of scientists agree with the theory of evolution. However, if one looks into the way the survey was conducted, Pew states that the survey of scientists was conducted online with a random sample of about 2,500 members of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And this American Association of the Advancement of Science has openly called ministries such as Answers in Genesis pseudoscience, and has a very clear policy on creation science. They believe that creation science cannot be taught and cannot be held to by their own members. So it is not accurate to say that the Pew survey represents all scientists, unless, of course, you are going to discount all of those, including the 600 master's degree and PhD holding associates of IAG, who believe in intelligent design and simply say that they are not scientists. Following? Okay. Good.
Out of all the evidence used to support the theory of evolution, what would you say is the strongest, most irrefutable single piece of evidence in support of the theory?
There's an enormous amount of evidence from all sorts of places, and it's hard to pick one strand which is more important than any other. There's fossils, there's the evidence from geographical distribution, there's the evidence from vestigial organs. I think, to me, perhaps the most compelling evidence is comparative evidence from modern animals, particularly biochemical comparative evidence, genetic, molecular evidence. If you take any set of animals and identify the same gene in different animals, and you really can do that because the letters of the DNA code, that's the same code in all animals, and you really can find a gene which is the same in, say, all mammals. For example, there's a gene called FOXP2, which is a couple of thousand letters long, and most of the letters are the same in any mammal, so you know it's the same gene. And then you go through, and you literally count the number of genes, a number of letters that are different. So in the case of FOXP2, if you count the number of letters that are different between humans and chimpanzees, it's only about 9. If you count the number of letters that are different in humans and mice, it's, I don't know, 30 or something like that. Different between humans. Actually, frogs have them as well, and you find a couple of hundred that are different. So you can take any pair of animals you like, kangaroo and lion, horse and cat, human and rat, any pair of animals you like, and count the number of differences in the letters of a particular gene, and you plot it out, and you find that it forms a perfect branching hierarchy. It's a tree. What else could that tree be but a family tree? And then you do the same thing for another gene. Having got the family tree for FOXP2, you then do the same thing for another gene, and another, and another. You get the same family tree. You also get the same family tree if you take genes that are no longer functional, that are just vestigial, they're not doing anything. It's like fragments of a document on your hard disk which are no longer being used. They're no longer on the directory, so you no longer see them. Again, you get the same family tree. This is overwhelmingly strong evidence. The only way you could get out of saying that that proves that evolution is true is by saying that the intelligent designer, God, deliberately set out to lie to us, deliberately set out to deceive us.
He spoke about DNA having a code, and that in itself disproves this whole theory. Because DNA does have a code of, I think it's 4 letters.
Mm.
And even if he wants to say that matter can happen by chance, a coded message never happens by chance. Whether it's binary, whatever type of language, it is always purposeful, and the very definition of a message, there has to be a coder, a message, which is the code, and a decoder. And that's exactly what DNA does.
Yeah.
So where does that come from?
Well, exactly, yeah. He's using DNA to prove evolution. Now, I mean, a lot of people don't really follow what he's talking about. Yes?
Something I can also see is the circular reasoning they use. Like, they use the assumption they start with as proof of the assumption.
Yeah.
Like, if we find fossils in a certain place, then evolution is true. So we find fossils in a certain place, thus evolution is true. It's like, constantly,
yes.
There's not something that proves anything.
Yeah, actually, you mentioned a couple of things, just sort of threw them out there, but actually, like vestigial organs, they used to believe there were over 100 vestigial organs in the human body. I can't remember what are they, like some very serious ones, like the liver is a vestigial and all. I mean, would you want one of these doctors to operate on you who believed in that? Or would you rather want somebody who believed in God and believed that God created the human body with intent and purpose and didn't make mistakes when he created the body with, maybe 100-odd vestigials that he left in us after billions of years of evolving us?
If you look at this and you're against it, so you're looking for the bad points, but if you look at this for learning, then you'll easily just be gullible and
Very easily. The fossil record, for example. The fossil record. You know that there is no such thing as a geological column. It's a made-up thing. You can't go anywhere and see the geological column where, you know, you have the... What's the very bottom one? The whatever they are. And, you know, the Cambrian, pre-Cambrian age and the Cambrian age and the Jurassic age and all these different ages. Depending on where they are in the column, that will determine how old the bones are. That thing does not exist. If you find it in textbooks, you don't find it in real life. So, anyway.
Yeah, it just sounds impressive because it's a whole bunch of big words.
Yeah.
With what they used to date bones and stuff, carbon dating, they took people who believe in creation, scientists, they took an old boot that was under immense heat in the desert and it had the boot label so they could tell when this company was around, and they took a bone from that foot, gave it to them to carbon date, and they said, "No, this is millions of years old." And then they showed them the boot, how it was founded in 1800s.
So yeah,
exactly. Anyway, if any of you are interested in the argument that he made about Fox P2, I can give you this to look through if you really want to. But basically, I have to actually read the whole thing to explain it. Don't worry too much about it. Okay, so he has another one of their very famous arguments. I don't know if you've ever seen this. So you have Horus, 3000 BC. Born on December 25th, born of a virgin, star in the east, adorned by three kings, baptized at age 30, 12 disciples. Attis, 1200 before Christ, born of a virgin, 25 December, crucified, died for 3 days, resurrected. Mithra, born of a virgin, 25 December, 12 disciples, performed miracles, dead for 3 days, resurrected. Krishna, born of a virgin, star in the east, performed miracles, and the list goes on till eventually you get to Jesus. And they say, well, all of these different mythological beings predate Jesus Christ, and so Jesus is just a carbon copy of all these other gods. Very popular, very common. If any of you have ever watched the Zeitgeist film, you will see that. It came out about maybe 10 years ago or something like that. It's still making the rounds. And so this is something that is popularized. The most popular version is the one with Horus. And so they say, oh, Horus was born on the 25th of December. Well, nobody knows that. Born of a virgin? Not actually. Now, I first heard this argument, I think I was about 16 or so, and it sort of shook me a bit. I was like, whoa, Christians copied all of these other guys. That's crazy. And then I went into a bookstore. So it was a bargain a secular bookstore, and had a book on Egyptian mythology. What do you call it? Egyptian mythology. So I went to go and read about Horus. I thought, let me find out for myself. I couldn't believe the stories that I was reading. If you know anything about Horus, you would never say he's anything like Jesus. Firstly, okay, born on the 25th of December, that's probably just made up. Born of a virgin. Well, not actually. Horus's father, Osiris, was killed. And then his wife wanted to have offspring, and so she raised him from the dead. He was a being that didn't have any private parts, and so she fashioned together genitalia from what she found in the swamp nearby, so that she could basically sleep with him and then have offspring. And then there was this big battle between Horus and his uncle Seth, between who's going to become the main god of all the other gods. And so they started to compete against each other. They had some very funny competitions, like who could row the fastest in a canoe made out of stone? Who could hold their breath for the longest? And I think after about 24 hours or something like that, Horus's mother shoots an arrow into the water to try and kill Seth to favor Horus, but she accidentally hits Horus. Horus gets so upset he jumps out of the water and chops his mother's head off. And then he runs away, and then Seth does a ritual to put his mother's head back on. And then Seth goes and catches Horus, and he takes him in front of all the other gods, and he rapes him in front of all the other gods. But the story actually gets quite weird and gross from there. But yeah, I won't go into it too much more. Until eventually, Horus's father calls out from the underworld, Horus must be the main guy. And so they said, oh, okay, Horus will be the main. So what has that got to do with Jesus? Well, not really anything. In fact, in all of these, you can go and look up all of their lives, and you will see that most of what they say is false. The closest one might be Attis. You might be able to say that he was born of a virgin, but it's a weird story. His mother went to an almond tree, and an almond fell off the tree and hit her stomach and entered into her stomach, and she became pregnant. That's the closest to the a virgin birth kind of story that you can really find. So anyway, a lot of it is just false. I was going to play this video of Richard Dawkins, and I want you to see the ignorance in his worldview.
What are the three most important unanswered questions in biology?
How does consciousness evolve, and what is consciousness? How did life itself begin from non-life? What was the origin of the first self-replicating molecule, the first gene, in effect? That would be the second one. And the third one would be, why do we have sex?
All right, those are the three most important questions that are unanswered by biology. What is consciousness? When did life start? Yeah, or when did non-life become life, actually?
Yes.
And why do we have sex? Right, so those are the big three things that, he cannot answer. I mean, even something as basic as that. Of course he doesn't know. God made man in his own image. He said, be fruitful and multiply and subdue the earth. And he gave us a gift we can use to be fruitful and to multiply. But in his worldview, it doesn't make sense. Why do we have this? Where did life start? When did non-life become? They don't know. That's a pretty big question, isn't it?
That's supposed to be the first question they asked of evolution. It's supposed to be the basis of evolution, but it's unanswered.
Yeah.
Why do you have consciousness?
We are more insignificant than we ever.
This is Lawrence Krauss talking, theoretical physicist, wrote the book Why There Is Something from Nothing, Why We Have Something Instead of Nothing.
Okay. Could have imagined you could get rid of us and all the galaxies and everything we see in the universe and be largely the same. So we're insignificant on a scale that Copernicus never would have imagined. And in addition, it turns out the future is miserable. So the two lessons that I like to give is, first, we're insignificant, and second, the future is miserable. Now, that you might think that should depress you, but I would argue that, in fact, it should embolden you and provide you a different kind of consolation. Because if the universe doesn't care about us, and if we're an accident in a remote corner of the universe, in some sense it makes us more precious. The meaning in our lives is provided by us. We provide our own meaning. And we are here by accidents, and we should enjoy our brief moment in the sun. We should make the most of our brief moment in the sun, because this is all we have. And even if we're so rare that we're the only life forms in the universe, which I doubt, that makes us, in some sense, while we're more insignificant, we're more special. We are endowed with a consciousness that can ask questions about the beginning of the universe and learn about the universe on its largest scales. And experience everything that it means to be human. Music, art, literature, and science. So for me, it should be spiritually uplifting that we're not created with a purpose by someone who takes care of us like a mannequin or with strings determining everything. We determine our future, and that makes our future more precious.
Hmm.
You said that we have spirits. Mm-hmm. Do they believe that animals have spirits?
I don't think they believe there is such a thing as a spirit. But spiritually, he probably, when he says, here we go, it is spiritually uplifting, he probably is just talking about personality or something like that. It's using terms that don't belong to him. I don't
know. Yeah, and he also said our spirit, though, not just yes. spiritually.
Yeah, so it. I don't know why they use it. They use terminology that doesn't belong to them. I mean, use your own, make your own terminology. Yeah. Leave ours alone.
It's to pervert. It's to pervert what its original meaning is supposed to be.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Whatever reason, even in a secular country like this, we have arrived at a point where there's a sort of latent belief within the popular consciousness that to be scientific is to somehow be sort of desiccated and dry and to miss out on the magic and mystery of one's experiences and the world and so on. You dispute that, right? So
not only dispute it, I mean, it's just the exact opposite of the truth. Science is wonderful. Science is amazing. The fact that you can understand why you exist, who could not be turned on, who could not be excited by that? Who would ever want to live in a world where you live your life, you go to work, you go to the office, whatever it is, you go to the football match, and this goes on year after year, and then you die, and you don't have any understanding of why you were there in the first place? That's desiccated, that's dry. What is not dry and desiccated is coming into the world, as it were, awakening in the world, and awakening in the fullest sense of seeing the universe, seeing the stars, seeing down a microscope, seeing what's inside every single cell, seeing what's inside the brain, and marvelling at this wonderful gift of life that we have, albeit temporarily, marvelling at this gift of understanding why we exist and rejoicing in it for as long as we do exist.
Richard Dawkins, thank you very much.
I don't understand. A gift.
It sounds almost like a Christian, doesn't it?
Yeah, I don't understand. A gift.
We should marvel at the gift of life and the gift of understanding as long as we exist.
Where does a gift come from?
Exactly. Anti-theists are constantly after something that their worldview does not provide, namely a purpose. You see this in Dawkins, you see it in Krauss. See, just look at their videos, listen to the way they speak. They're constantly looking for something. Did you notice how Richard Dawkins, at least twice, maybe more, but at least twice, spoke about knowing why you are here.
Yeah.
Science helps you to know why you are here. No, it doesn't. No, they believe the reason we're here is an accident, which is no reason. There is no reason in their worldview, actually. So, what is our response? First, we have a consistent worldview. We believe there is purpose in life. We believe in a God who is sovereign and in control of time, space, matter, and history. And therefore, we can believe in consistency and uniformity in nature. Why do we believe that? Okay. If I drop this pen, you think it's going to hit the ground?
Yeah.
Yes.
Why?
Because the law of gravity.
How do you know the law of gravity is not going to change?
Because it's constant.
Because it's been like that my whole life.
Oh, so it's been like that your whole life, so that proves that it's going to be like that in the future.
No, it's created like that.
Yes. It was created like that. It's a good answer. It was created like that. And, oh, what do you know? It still works.
Oh, wow.
There's still the sovereign God who is in control over all these things. We have a consistent worldview. You can account for things like that. We have evidence to support the claims of the Bible. Historical evidence, archaeological evidence. We have evidence for the claims of the Bible.
But also like that thing you're showing us just now with Krishna and all of them. That's all mythology. There's no proof that any of those existed. So how is that even the same thing? Because there's proof that Jesus existed.
Well, they say no, he didn't exist.
Really?
But there's non-Christian scientific historical proof. Even from non-Christians.
Yeah, they will say there might have been a Jesus figure, but certainly the Gospels are not reliable in their report of him. Probably didn't die on the cross, didn't rise from the dead.
So
all those things were all made up.
They say it's mass, when you dream or see something that's illusions, which is completely unscientific.
That would be a greater miracle.
Yes.
Than actually Jesus being resurrected.
Yeah. So,
all those accounts of people seeing the exact same
But that aside, what actually predates the oldest one, which is Horus, let's say, Horus 3000 BC? There's something that actually predates Horus in our faith. Messianic figure in our faith predates Horus 3000 BC. There's a particular belief that started with Adam and Eve. What was that belief? First promise of Jesus Christ in the Bible.
You shall know. He's stepping on the snake. We never looked at Genesis 3:15.
Genesis 3:15, there we go. He will bruise his head. Your seed shall bruise his head, and he will bruise your heel. The first promise of Jesus Christ. Messianic promise. And people were looking forward to him from that day on. So if other religions popped up along the way, all of them have their roots in Adam and Eve, in fact. So I'm not all that bothered, even if there were other pre-figures of Christ in other religions, which they weren't. I mean, it's not real. But even if they were, I wouldn't be all that bothered by it.
So they all say that people had this illusion of Jesus, and then they wrote the Bible to support their claims.
Who?
The atheists.
Oh, no. I'm using that as an argument because I believe that every people group comes from Adam and Eve, so you will see some similarities in belief systems around the world.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people, I can't speak for every single religious group, but there's this idea of a God in heaven, or a big supreme being. In almost every religion, people are always looking for this big supreme being. There's often messianic figures, a belief in some kind of salvation, maybe not from sin, but some way of getting to this higher being. So even if those facts were true, I would attribute it to that. But those facts aren't true anyway, so don't worry about it. Yeah?
I'm reading this book, After the Flood, at the moment.
Yes.
And in one of the first chapters, it addresses the fact that many religions, even before they met, say, Jews, had the idea of an omnipotent God who created everything. And there's quotes from Egypt, China, all over the world, where it basically describes the God the same we did in the Bible.
Yeah.
So it's
very, very fascinating thing to look into is God in ancient China. Before Buddhism came to China, what the Chinese believe, very, very similar to a higher being that you find in the scriptures. It's fascinating. And the Chinese language as well actually points to it. They, what do you call it when you study, like, the etymology of the Chinese words, but more the letters. I don't know what you call that, this particular science. Anyway, let me finish up here. Second, we have evidence to support the claims of the Bible. Third, we have logical arguments which demand a creator, a communicator, and a savior. We have these logical arguments. Why do we have something instead of nothing? Why has God created us in a way that we have understanding, in a way that we communicate? If there is a God who has communicated to us, how has he communicated to us? Why do we have this longing to be saved from our sins? Most importantly, we have the gospel. Whatever your apologetic approach is, whatever argumentation you use, it should only serve as a platform, if you will, to preach the gospel to a person. We can argue with atheists until we're blue in the face. It's not going to help unless we give them the gospel. You can ask a lot of atheists, would you believe in God if I could prove God's existence to you? No, your God is a monster and I'm not interested in him at all. And so there comes a point at which we have to firmly give that person the gospel because they know that God exists. They are suppressing that truth and unrighteousness. All right, any questions?
I've heard Richard Dawkins say asking questions like why we're here, purpose questions, is the category error. It's like asking what is the color of jealousy? There is no answer to it. It's a nonsensical question. So it's interesting that in that he goes on about, oh, we can know why we're here.
And yeah.
Why we're here. It's just because in by his own admission, it's a nonsensical question.
Yeah, and he has to make that argument because the whole, almost the whole premise of his God delusion movement is, you think there's a God because you are asking why there is this apparent design, why do we have the sense of purpose, why do we see the beauties of creation? And he says, I mean, those things are, it's not the case, it's just the product of evolution. Yeah, exactly.
But I think they themselves ask questions to get their answers on evolution.
Yes.
They want to get the answers to give answers to people to believe in evolution.
Which are ultimately just made up.
And the thing is that it is a fallacy, and therefore it will contradict each other, because they cannot perfect every single aspect because it isn't true. So there will have to be contradictions, because that doesn't work.
Yeah. Yes.
What I actually want to ask about the Anakin was, they actually believe the Bible is not true, and it's like made up.
Yes.
So when they say that this whole type of Christianity, do they say people saw Jesus and they started believing it and they wrote the Bible, or how? Why do they? Where do they think about things?
How
do they explain the Bible?
How do they excuse it?
Yeah.
How do they excuse the Bible? I don't think they really care much about how it came about. They're more interested in proving that it is fallacious, that it is full of myth. Fabrications, things that simply aren't true, things that are anti-scientific. And so I haven't heard one of them try and give a reason for why the Bible was written, but just that it is nonsense. I even used showed me all the picture of Horus and all the different things. And I said, can I just compare these characters to Jesus Christ and tell you about some of the prophecies that he fulfilled in the Old Testament? And the likelihood of one individual fulfilling all the prophecy that Jesus Christ fulfilled is impossible. Impossible if it is just random. Right? And he said, exactly. It's impossible. There's no way there could be one man who fulfilled all of those prophecies. It's impossible that Jesus even existed to begin with. They're totally not open to reasoning about the scriptures at all. They don't care why it's there. They just care that it's fake and false.
I spoke with more than one atheist I spoke with at UCPs. A lot of the times used the word randomness, that it is all random. So within all the logic and all the trying to have facts, it's still based on randomness, which is kind of confusing, but it makes sense and why they want to, like, don't see the purpose.
Yeah.
Sometimes I just feel overwhelmed, like I watched part of the debate between Abraham and Goliath, and I just like feel, why am I even watching this? Because he's like, he's not even open.
Yeah.
You're like,
yeah. Well, Bill Nye probably won't change his mind, but it's a good debate to have because there are people watching. And so that's often the purpose of a debate. The debaters are not going to try to convince each other. They're trying to convince the people watching them.
Yeah, it's not really a debate. It's just putting forth your argument for the people to see, decide what the truth is.
Yeah. I mean, an excellent debater who does that well is James White. Should watch him debate cultists and these different people, and he will eventually ignore the person he's debating, and he'll turn his attention to the people in the crowd who are watching the debate, and he'll appeal to them to listen to the truth and obey the truth. And he's made his argument with the debater, he's shown the flaws and holes in the argument, but then he turns his attention to the crowd. He's very, very good at doing that, and that's the purpose of a debate like that.